this morning. Nicholas Gash versus Rosalind Franklin University. All right, the room is quieting down. Ms. Davis.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tara Davis, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Nicholas Gash. This matter comes before your honors today because the district court improperly granted the university's motion to dismiss the plaintiff's amended complaint. Plaintiff is requesting a reversal of those portions of the district court's decision, which granted the motion and dismissed his Title IX and breach of contract claims. The district court's decision should be reversed because the amended complaint plausibly alleged both a Title IX and a breach of contract claim. When assessing a 12B6 motion to dismiss, the court must accept all factual allegations in the complaint as true, must construe the complaint in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and must draw all reasonable inferences in the plaintiff's favor. The district court failed to do so here, warranting a reversal.
Ms. Davis, what was different about this situation for your client because he was a man?
So a number of things, starting with a decision to investigate the matter from the beginning. This alleged conduct occurred off campus, and the university's Title IX director decided to have the matter investigated and adjudicated. That was the first in a series of procedural irregularities, all of which went against the plaintiff and none of which went against the complainant, Jane Roe.
Does that make it accuser-centered versus male-female-centered?
So at this stage, and based on the number of procedural irregularities that occurred, again, all of which went against the plaintiff and adversely impacted him alone, and none of which adversely impacted the complainant, Jane Roe, there is a plausible inference that it was based on gender bias. And some of the other irregularities I'd like to point out occurred during the hearing and adjudication process. This included the removal of both parties from the hearing during the testimony of the witnesses.
Like it's contrary to the regulations, but it was both parties. It was both genders.
That's correct. It was contrary to the regulations and both parties were removed from the hearing. However, the significant point is that the parties were not similarly situated, meaning the plaintiff as the accused was in a much different position and had much more to lose should he be found responsible, which he ultimately was, and sanctioned, which he ultimately was, with an expulsion. There is a reason that the Constitution provides for a right to confront witnesses to an accused. There is a well-accepted precedent and recognition that an accused is in a much different position, and his inability to hear the examination of the witnesses, all five of which were adverse to him and were identified by the complainant, Jane Roe, severely impacted him and led to a finding by the hearing panel that he was responsible. Also during the hearing,
that sounds like an argument to me that the procedures that are applied or were applied are problematic in your client's view, but what evidence or what is there that would allow an inference that the application of the procedures was because of his gender?
So the important point to keep in mind is that as this court discussed in Doe versus Purdue University in 2019, the court has to look at the totality of the evidence. So even if we look at just this particular fact in isolation, if that's not sufficient on its own, it's really a matter of whether when all of the facts alleged are considered, is there a plausible inference of bias? And some other errors that occurred during the hearing, I think, further highlight the impact to the plaintiff, the male accused alone, including the fact that his advisor was continually prohibited from asking the complaining party any relevant questions. So critical, objectively relevant questions, such as those that related to the alleged misconduct. He also was prohibited.
Do you see this case as factually similar to Purdue?
There are some similarities. It's a different factual background. There's no, you know, set list of facts that have to be established to meet the plausibility thresholds for a Title IX claim when faced with a motion to dismiss. But I think there were equally concerning errors that occurred here, particularly during the hearing process, some of which I just mentioned, in addition to the fact that the plaintiff's advisor was not able to question the complaining party, Jane Roe, about anything she said in her opening statement, which presumed that what she was claiming had happened was true. So when plaintiff's advisor attempted to ask questions to point out inconsistencies or things that she had said that made her account not credible, that she had said during her initial opening remarks, he was prohibited from doing so. He also was prohibited from asking the quote unquote outcry witness about what the complaining party had told her. So there were just a number of errors that occurred during the hearing process, again, all of which went against the plaintiff only, and which prevented his advisor from exploring the credibility in Jane Roe's account. The hearing panel also ultimately found that the plaintiff was responsible, as I mentioned, and expelled him. But what they failed to recognize was that it was undisputed that the plaintiff was incapacitated by the university's own definition, meaning he could not and was not capable of consenting to sexual activity. The hearing panel disregarded this entirely. There was no discussion about it. It wasn't even mentioned in the hearing panel's decision letter. So that's another indication of how the male accused was treated differently and, again, plausibly suggest that gender bias was a potential motivating factor here. The investigator also conducted an investigation that was far from thorough, which further raises another procedural irregularity. And she failed to fairly summarize the relevant evidence, which is another violation of the 2020 Title IX regulations. And the way that she conducted her investigation was by conducting interviews with the parties. There was no follow-up. There was no probing questions that were asked of the complaining party, Jane Roe. And ultimately, she produced a report that was about 5 or 6 pages and really lacked in any substance. The hearing panel further... Or I'm sorry, rather, the one other point I wanted to raise and something else that was discussed in Doe versus Purdue was the external pressure that was created on the university. So the 2011 Dear Colleague letter led to a sea change in how universities handled and responded to sexual assault complaints. And this, the atmosphere that was created persists to this day. So whether there have been a rescission of the rules or they're currently undergoing proposed rulemaking changes, that atmosphere and the culture that impacted campuses and the university's concern about being subjected to an investigation or having federal funds withdrawn, that continues. And that's, again, not something to be viewed in isolation, but rather viewed in the totality in light of all of the circumstances to determine if there is a plausible inference. Again, we're at the motion to dismiss stage, so not whether, you know, the plaintiff may ultimately prevail on a motion for summary judgment or at trial. But at this point, is there enough to plausibly suggest that there was a gender bias motivation enough to get him past the hurdle of the initial motion to dismiss and to be able to conduct discovery in this matter? And unless the court has further questions, I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Ms. Smith.
May it please the court, Jennifer Smith for Rosalind Franklin University. So first I want to address this concept raised by counsel that there was different stakes for the parties, and so procedural errors hit them differently. The stakes for the parties were access to education for both of them. Title IX says those who are subjected to sexual harassment must be corrected and or, you know, addressed so that they continue to have access. So there's no difference in stakes. The stake was access to education for both parties.
There's a difference in consequences.
What's that?
There's a difference in consequences. A student who's accused of sexual assault or sexual harassment, some other sex-based offense that implicates Title IX, is subject to a whole array of discipline, including up to and including expulsion, which is what happened here. The right. complaining party is not.
A complaining party.
I think that's
party,
what the argument pertains to.
But the stakes are just as severe. A complaining party.
Okay, let's
who
change
has
the word
to
consequences. Okay. What are the consequences of this proceeding?
The consequences
for
the
respondent
for the
are severe. The consequences for the complainant are non-existent.
No, they're going.
They're caught.
They're
caught free.
They're seeing the person who sexually assaulted you in class and having a safe learning environment.
I'm talking about the proceeding itself. What are the consequences that flow from the proceeding? There's no downside consequence for the complaining party to falsify testimony.
Right? Yes, there is. Complaining party can be subject to discipline for falsifying testimony. That is absolutely also violates rules, but they would be subject to their own disciplinary hearing.
The consequences for the parties in this proceeding are one-sided. Only the respondent is subject to sanctions at the end of the process.
Well, the parties in this proceeding are the university, and the university has a interest that's fundamental to education, to providing a safe learning environment. So in this case, but at the proceeding, at the Title IX proceeding, we disagree that the complainant did not have an interest in the outcome.
I'm not talking about an interest in the outcome, and I don't think that's what your opponent's argument is. The argument is that the accused has more to lose in this proceeding than the complainant does. That's just self-evident, right?
I don't think it is, but I've said why, and so I'll move off that point. So when we're looking at the Title IX case, the question is gender discrimination, not a redo of and whether the university discriminated, and that was evident in some of your questions. It was brought up the totality of the circumstances. Does it suggest gender discrimination? There was no explicit, statement in the complaint that there was some reference to gender, but instead the allegation is the totality of unfairness alleged amounts to gender discrimination. First of all, the supposed many errors, even as alleged, are not errors. So I want to first address the alleged public pressure. This case is different from other cases that have come before because of the timing.
If we grant you that, I'd like to move you to another alleged area.
Yeah.
And that's the jurisdiction. Off campus, bar, drinking, off campus allegations of sexual assault, not a university-based event. If the university does not have jurisdiction, what consequences would that have for this proceeding?
So jurisdiction under Title IX is different than jurisdiction to address the conduct. So that's where I'm confused by the argument, because they're saying Title IX does not apply, does not give the requirement that the university address that conduct, but Title IX doesn't prohibit the university from having its own policy or state law.
Of RFU identical to Title IX. It was the same language, right?
Well, what we know, because we're at the motion to dismiss stage, is they had a policy that, according to, as it's alleged, addressed both Title IX and equal access to education. So it could be identical, or it could not be, but there would be no harm. Title IX at this point, after the 2020 regulations, provides respondents, those accused, with more robust rights and process than is afforded in any other area of student misconduct. So to give Title IX rights to the plaintiff at the hearing stage would only give him more process, more protection, and wouldn't be a procedural violation that showed gender discrimination. It would be a pro-respondent
application. The question is whether the university extended its jurisdiction to adjudicate this complainant's complaint to an off-campus event over which it did not have substantial control, which is the test under the regulations and under your policy,
right,
your client's policy. And the irregularity of that is what the plaintiff argues is suggestive of sex-based violence, or I'm sorry, sex-based bias in this case, because they extended the hearing administrator extended the university's jurisdiction to an off-campus occurrence that it doesn't have any jurisdiction over.
It does have jurisdiction. It just because
it has substantial control over an off-campus.
When a student complains another student sexually harassed them and complains to the university about the impact that's having here, as pled, the appeal that was considered in the appeal. The party appealed beyond the hearing, and the university looked at that issue and said, we did have jurisdiction over this conduct, and we were right to discipline you for it. And again, whether or not that falls under Title IX or its policy that's pled, there's a policy that might have, we don't have the full policy, but the pleadings acknowledge a policy. It doesn't harm or show gender discrimination.
Is it a breach of contract?
No, it's not a breach of contract either, because we have no allegation that there was some contractual guarantee to not disciplining someone who sexually harasses their fellow student. And
the policy only applies, and Title IX only applies to occurrences over which the university at locations at which the university has exercised substantial control.
And that is not equivalent to off campus. Substantial control can mean different things, and in other cases have been found to be off campus conduct. And here, this university reviewed that issue and found it did have jurisdiction over this conduct.
The complaint alleges that this was procedurally irregular because of what the policy says and what the Title IX regulations say about the university's jurisdiction to adjudicate these complaints. So is that not something we just accept as an allegation in the complaint, rather than try to resolve it at this stage?
They don't allege that it's conclusory to say it's irregular. They don't allege other cases where there was a female respondent and they did not pursue it because it was off campus. There's, other than their conclusory statement, this is irregular, we have nothing on that point. And it's self-evident in the Title IX regulations that say universities are not restricted from addressing things that are beyond the scope of our regulations. So with that, my time is called.
All right. Ms. Davis, you had some time in rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for the university claims that the alleged procedural errors were not necessarily errors because, or at least that the complaint didn't allege that. And when saying that the procedural errors were irregular, what we mean by that, and if the court has any questions on this, I'm glad to clarify, but we mean that it was not in line with either the Title IX regulations and or the university's policy. So the complaint in our briefing makes clear that there were, again, a number of procedural issues or errors, again, all of which went against the plaintiff and none of which went against Jane Roe, the complaining party.
What if we had all of these irregularities, as I argued, and the accuser and the respondent are flipped? Mm-hmm. What about the maleness or the femaleness inserts the gender aspect?
So I think one of the more significant points is the fact that the university found or failed to investigate or look into whatsoever the fact that the plaintiff, the male accused, was incapable of consenting. Again, this issue was undisputed. It was made known to the Title IX director and the investigator early on in the process because it was included in Jane Roe's own statement in the investigation report, and they failed to take any action despite having actual knowledge of that. So I think if the roles were reversed, I think it would be clear that if the university had information that a female student was incapable of consenting by the university's own policies to the point that she had no recollection of a period of 7 to 8 hours that night as to what happened, I think there's a decent presumption that the university would take steps to address that. So that in particular is one issue that I see as being particularly indicative of gender bias. And I see that my time is up. Thank you very much. And again, I would just respectfully request that the court reverse the district court's decision.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and we'll move to our fifth case.